You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Major League Baseball says it's going to get tough on pitchers who load up the baseball with quote-unquote sticky stuff. Coming up, we'll learn about the steps the league is taking, how it's going to enforce it, and we'll check in on how the Milwaukee Brewers are doing so far this season. Now, Wisconsin's tourism industry lost almost $4 billion in 2020 compared to the previous year, as a lot of families understandably put off travel because of the pandemic. In Wisconsin Dells, there are already signs that this year's tourism season is going to make up for that deficit and then some. Rob Mentzer has more.
It's early in the summer tourism season in Wisconsin Dells, and it is already sweltering. At a water park at the Wilderness Resort, kids are waiting in line for their turn at the water slides. Grandmothers are floating on the lazy river. Jada Walton spent the last year in virtual school. She's enjoying this trip with her aunt, uncle, and cousin.
It feels good. It feels nice to finally be back to kind of sort of normal.
Jada's uncle, Thomas Billups, lives in suburban Chicago. He says after more than a year of staying home, being back out in public is an adjustment.
It doesn't feel natural just yet, but, you know, I'm just kind of working my way into it slowly. But, yeah, it still doesn't feel natural.
There are a lot of people who didn't travel last year due to COVID-19, but who now are newly vaccinated and ready to make use of their new freedom. Bookings are up in tourist spots across northern Wisconsin, and managers at Wisconsin Dells big resorts are expecting a massive tourism season, maybe a record-breaking one.
It is going to be a good year. We can tell looking at reservations that we have for June, July, and August compared to 2019 at the same time that we're already significantly ahead by 12 to 13% compared to 2019.
Joe Eck is the chief operating officer at the Wilderness. It's a sprawling 600-acre resort with more than 1,100 employees and 6,000 guests on an average summer weekend. Last year, all Wisconsin Dells resorts closed abruptly in March during the COVID-19 shutdown. When they reopened just over a year ago, they didn't know what would happen.
We're in the business of tourism and, you know, service, and to not have as many people as you had in years past, you know, it put a scare in a lot of people, and a lot of people, I'm sure, wondered if their business model would succeed. Is it going to be the same 1 year from now?
Across Wisconsin, the tourism industry took a 30% hit in 2020. In Wisconsin Dells, the decline was about half that. But it was a hard season, with more friction than usual between visitors and workers, between workers and employers. People were on edge about the pandemic, or their business, or both. There were some businesses that didn't make it. But today, those look like the exception in Wisconsin Dells, not the rule.
How are we doing?
Of course, there are new challenges. On a golf cart ride across the resort, Eck points out the dorms that, in a typical summer, would house 400 exchange students brought to the U.S. as guest workers. Right now, they have 110 student workers. They're hoping that rises to about 200 this month. Fewer students are being approved for foreign travel because foreign embassies are still closed due to the pandemic. In the absence of guest workers, employers are having to increase incentives for domestic ones and cross-train their workers to fill in the gaps. John Chasten is general manager of the Kalahari Resort.
There hasn't been minimum wage jobs in the Dells for years. Our average hourly wage is up quite a bit, which comes from us increasing the wages of our current employees, hiring at higher wages. And so we're just at a different place than we were even in 2019.
Rising wages are good for workers. They're also translating into higher prices for visitors to the Dells. So far, that's not stopping people from coming. Despite the full parks, though, things aren't totally back to normal yet. Chasten says about half of the Kalahari's business comes from conventions. Those mostly haven't returned. They expect that side of their business won't be back to normal until 2022. Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Those early indicators are making it look like a really good year for Wisconsin tourism. As vaccination rates climb, so do the number of folks traveling. We're taking a look back at how 2020 turned Wisconsin tourism on its head and how this year looks like maybe a complete 180. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you traveled in Wisconsin already this summer, or do you have plans in the works? Where did you go? Where are you going? Do you work in a part of the state that depends on tourism? Do you work in a business that depends on tourism? Love to hear from you and what you're seeing 2020 versus 2021. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ann Sayers is Acting Secretary for the Wisconsin Department of Tourism. Ann, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we just heard Rob Mentzer. He's hearing a lot of optimism, it sounds like, from tourism-related businesses. Are you hearing similar things from where you're sitting at the Department of Tourism?
We are. That was such a great report, and it does reflect what we're hearing and what we're actually seeing in the data as well. Folks are sad to have missed out on those vacation plans last year, and they are looking at 21 thinking now is the time to reconnect, refresh, discover something new in Wisconsin, and make those memories, make up for lost time. They are out there to get revenge on a year's worth of missed travel.
Let's take a look back at 2020. It was bad for tourism in Wisconsin, no mistaking that. But a lot of things I'm seeing say, you know, it wasn't as bad as we had feared. Could you look back at 2020 and how travel ended up shaping up?
Yeah, I mean, it's no secret. It was a tough year in so many respects. But if it taught us anything in the tourism industry, it's that tourism is a major economic driver, and it supports our communities across the state, both rural and urban. And even in what ended up being our toughest year, we still are a $17.3 billion industry in Wisconsin. We still welcomed nearly 91 million visitors, and we still supported over 157,000 jobs. So those are our friends and neighbors whose livelihoods depend on tourism. That's more people by a large margin than live in the city of Green Bay. So this is a critical industry to our state. And even in a tough year, we really saw that come through.
Now, you just used the word revenge, and you've used the word phrase revenge travel elsewhere. So you're thinking that we're not just going to see kind of a resumption of the old normal of tourism. There's it sounds like pent up demand that you're seeing from those people, like you said, who couldn't travel last year.
We are, and I don't know about you, but I'm feeling it too. It's there's something about not being able to travel that reminds you of why it's just so special to have that freedom and that opportunity to do so. So many of us leave those unused vacation days on the table at the end of the year and just kind of watch them go away. I don't think that's happening this year. Folks are not going to miss this opportunity to get back out there, but travel more, pack in more weekends of travel, travel for longer, travel maybe in larger party sizes. We're seeing all of these trends right now, and that's where we get that revenge travel phrase. It's happening.
One thing that isn't bouncing back so quickly, as we heard from Rob Mentzer there, convention travel in the state, a big moneymaker for an area like Wisconsin Dells, not just the Dells, though. What is your outlook for getting those conventions back into the state?
You're right. That's a huge part of the return on investment that we see in the tourism industry. And conventions are going to take a little bit longer. It's going to look a little bit more like a dial than a switch. But the good news is that dial is turning. When you look out to the later part of the summer and into the fall, weekends are starting to book, and we're watching things kind of percolate back up. So it's going to happen, but it will take a little longer than that. Leisure travel is certainly the one that's going to spring back faster.
Ann Sayers is with us, Acting Secretary for the Wisconsin Department of Tourism. We're talking about what looks to be a big year for travel in our state, a bounce back, a revenge travel. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Is your line of work dependent on tourism in Wisconsin? Are you a business owner? Or do you work at a place that really counts on that travel? And if you are traveling, what do you have in mind for Wisconsin this year? What did you do last year? Did you find ways to travel? Maybe a road trip, outdoor recreation? What are you looking forward to the rest of this summer? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You could also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Acting Secretary of Wisconsin's Department of Tourism, Ann Sayers, looking at travel in Wisconsin. By all signs, a big return of travel in the state compared to last year. The big pandemic year, of course, put the kibosh on a lot of travel. Now people are ready. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you ready for travel yourself? What is on your agenda around Wisconsin? Do you work in a tourism-related business around the state? How's this year looking, especially compared to last year for you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Secretary Sayers, last year, I think a lot of people turned to road trips and driving tours. And I know there's some new developments with federal recognition for some roadways here in Wisconsin. Can you talk about that side of tourism in the state?
Yeah, they're calling 2021 the year of the return of the Great American Road Trip, and Wisconsin is so well positioned for that. Even in normal years, about 90% or more of our travelers arrive by personal vehicle. So the fact that we're putting greater emphasis on that this year, such good news for us, especially because, like you said, we have some really important recognitions that have just recently come down. The 70-mile Lake Superior National Scenic Byway, this follows the southern shoreline of Lake Superior, and it's just, you know, breathtaking. Taking views of forests and pristine sandy beaches, and of course, the clear waters of Lake Superior. So that's a big one. Door County's Coastal National Byway. This is over 66 miles along the Door County Peninsula, highlighting, of course, the Bay of Green Bay and the Niagara Escarpment. Just gorgeous. And then one of our crown jewels, the Wisconsin Great River Road, is a national scenic byway, but it was just recently designated an All-American Road by the U.S. Department of Transportation. It's 250 miles. It winds its way through 33 Mississippi River towns. And this is such a great way to experience a new place. So you know, can stop at a roadside attraction, grab a piece of pie. Maybe there's some arts and culture offerings, some agritourism, just a great way to explore new places. We're expecting a lot more of that this summer.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Luke is with us in Green Bay. Luke, hi.
Hi, nice to be on the air. I was calling to get the question about, you know, some of the things you did or experienced during the pandemic and travel. Last year, my wife and I, we went up to the Boundary Waters. We both teach, so we had the opportunity to have summers off. And we spent pretty much the whole summer in the BWCA. And it was interesting because it was busier than I'd ever seen it in the past. And I think a lot of people experienced a lot more wilderness outdoor experiences because they were available and safer, and so it was an awesome experience being out there for that amount of time, and it's great to see people also, you know, getting out and maybe experiencing things that they hadn't before, and sort of that economy I think did okay, and I think a lot of the outfitters, at least on the U.S. side, the Canadian side, the border wasn't open, but you know, had a lot of people showing interest. And I'll be interested when I go up there this year to see if that's continuing. The other thing that I found interesting was, though, with like that influx of people in those sort of wild spaces, is how much sometimes humans can love a place to death, you know, and how we also have impact on places we tread, you know, and people kind of learning those rules, because as it was great to see our people there, there's also certain rules that people need to sort of abide by in a wilderness space, you know, leave no trace and
exactly.
And things Luke, like that.
I want to bring Secretary Sayers in on this. Luke, thanks for that call. And I'll point you toward a conversation we had a while back with someone from the DNR. And there, you use the words yourself, Luke, leave no trace campaign. To Luke's first point, though, Secretary Sayers, and we've heard this a lot, people may be going out and canoeing, hiking in places for the first time. For what you're seeing so far, have we built a new generation, a new group of people who are going to keep doing that now, even in the years to come?
Well, that is sort of the next challenge ahead of us. Luke is not alone. You know, outdoor recreation has been a top driver of tourism forever here in Wisconsin. But in 2020, it was the number one driver of tourism. So, and we're seeing it again here in 2021 already, year over year, from January to April, from last year to this year, 32% increase in state park visitation, a 9.5% increase in fishing licenses. And get this, 203% increase in camping nights completed or reserved already this year. So yes, people are sort of rediscovering the outdoors, and we're really happy here at the Department of Tourism because we recently became home to the Office of Outdoor Recreation, and they're making it their mission to help folks who are new to the outdoors, who discovered it maybe during the pandemic, to make that a lifelong habit and to find new ways to stay outside and keep, I mean, it's really kind of a silver lining in all of this is discovering the outdoors. So we want to help people continue to do that.
Luke, thanks a lot for sharing your experience. I appreciate it. At 800-642-1234. Secretary Sayers, we've heard, you know, tourism-focused communities like the Dells. We've talked about nature a little bit. How about cities in Wisconsin that rely on at least some tourism for part of their business? What are we seeing there?
Well, cities are great, especially when you're in a large party, because there's something for everyone. So you can just assure that everyone in your party is going to go home with the kind of story that they want to tell, a memory that's special to them. So whether you're looking at incredible culinary experiences, unique lodging, maybe it's arts and culture, or even urban outdoor rec can be a lot of fun. So that's looking very good. And it also helps that so many of these large events are coming back online this year, like Summerfest, like the State Fair, and so many more.
Go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Russ is with us now in Stoughton. Russ, hi.
Hi. I generally go up to Boulder Junction in September for fishing trips. And when I was up there last September, I discovered I went into town to see if I could get breakfast, and there all the restaurants were out of business. There was one bar, one sporting goods store, one souvenir store, and one gas station open, and everything else was out of business. It looks like they have really suffered during the pandemic.
Russ, thanks for that call and that report. Secretary Sayers, I know there was a concern that some businesses that rely on tourism weren't going to make it until after the pandemic. What do we know so far?
Yeah, well, I encourage Russ to take a look again here in the future. Things are, like I said, kind of coming back as a dial, not a switch. And with that federal stimulus funds, and we're really proud here at the Department of Tourism to have been supporting local tourism destinations with some of that federal money through the pandemic. It was hard for businesses, but they put that money to good use. They've been working overtime to figure out how to stay open, how to offer that incredible customer experience. So I think you can expect that more things will be coming back online.
Thanks for the call, Russ. Now, we heard a shortage of labor, in part because anybody who's gone to the Dells over the years knows they count on a lot of students from Eastern Europe and elsewhere to staff the water slides and whatnot. And also, it's harder for people to travel from abroad to Wisconsin. A lot of countries still have their own big COVID problems. How much of a damper for both labor and customers is international travel right now?
Yeah, that is the challenge right now. And it's we're coming out of this thing, but we're still building back. And so this is a piece of it. It's been wonderful to see the incredible innovation going on in the hospitality industry to make sure that these challenges aren't reflected in the customer experience. And, you know, it's a lot of folks don't know, when we put up advertising dollars, they actually do double, triple, and quadruple duty in terms of setting a perception for the state as a place you might want to locate a business or come and work as an employee or come to school or retire. And so I think that's a part of the long-term solution, is that getting the word out about Wisconsin, what an incredible place this is for visitors and residents alike, is one way that we can tackle the workforce shortage in the long term.
Let's take a minute or two before we run out of time to ask what's on your travel itinerary for the rest of the summer. I imagine you have to make many stops around the state. What are some that you're looking forward to?
Oh my gosh, what's not on my agenda? I want to do as much al fresco dining as I possibly can. I'm going to take in all the live music. I'm definitely feeling the need to check out some arts and culture that felt like a really missing thing through the pandemic. And then, of course, outdoor recreation. I discovered so many new trails in the past year, and I know there's millions more for me to go discover. So it's all on the agenda this year.
Yeah, you mentioned, I hadn't thought about asking about that in terms of tourism, but museums and other art-type institutions, obviously most of them closed for most of last year. What are you looking forward to there?
Well, I was very lucky to head to the Milwaukee Museum earlier this year and see the Nelson Mandela exhibit. That's there for a little bit longer. Folks have to check that out. There's some new art museums opening up in Sheboygan. And then all of our old favorites are open again, accepting visitors, and have such great things to share with us.
And then in terms of events, you mentioned Summerfest making a later start, but still happening this year, it looks like. What are some of the other big events that are big local economic drivers are you looking forward to the return of?
Gosh, there's a lot going on. You know, Summerfest had 800,000 tickets available and they were sold out in just 5 minutes. So we're not alone in wanting to get back out there and experience those things. Ryder Cup is huge international interest that's coming to Kohler this year. NASCAR Cup at Road America, EAA, they're expecting huge crowds. And while I think the international visitation to that particular air show event will be down, I think it's going to fill in with the domestic visitors too. And then of course, the state fair and all those local county fairs are back too.
Secretary Sayers, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Ann Sayers is the acting secretary for the Wisconsin Department of Tourism. We talked to her about Wisconsin summer travel and the potential to come back after a rough year in 2020. Also heard a report from Rob Mentzer on that topic. And there's still time for you to share your travel plans in Wisconsin this summer or beyond if you'd like. A couple ways to let us know. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. That's at Central Time WPR. Or send us an email right now, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. If we get a few stories, I'll share them on the air, maybe even next week. Again, tweet us your travel plans in Wisconsin at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up, the latest Major League Baseball scandal, sticky stuff on the baseball. We'll find out how Major League Baseball is looking to crack down on pitchers doctoring the ball. It's only been illegal a century, so you can see why it'd be tough to catch up with that. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. Remember, you can follow all of our conversations with the Wisconsin Public Radio app. Drop that onto your smartphone or tablet. Listen wherever you go. And, of course, check out archives, news, and live streams online at WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, while some developers are working on cars that drive themselves, others are working on vehicles that can fly. No more traffic jams, no more starts and stops. We'll learn more about the idea and when we might see these flying taxis coming up. Now, there's a scene in the baseball movie Major League in which veteran pitcher Eddie Harris is explaining to his young teammate Rick Wild Thing Vaughn why he's got various forms of grease under his jersey.
Any one of them will give you another 2 to 3 inches drop on your curveball. Of course, if the umps are watching me close, I just rub a little jalapeno inside my nose, get it running, and if I need to load the ball up a little, just wipe my nose.
You put snot on the ball?
I haven't got an arm like yours. I got to put anything on it I can find.
Well, in the midst of record strikeouts and overall poor hitting this season, Major League Baseball says it's going to get tough on pitchers who use illegal foreign substances to doctor the baseball. It's already against the rules, but it hasn't exactly been heavily enforced. Starting next week, umpires will conduct regular checks of all pitchers through every game. If you get caught, you'll be ejected and suspended, but with pay, for 10 games. The penalty goes up for repeat offenders. Tom Hodricourt is the Brewers beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He talked to us from Denver earlier today. Well, I did a little poking around, Tom. This sort of doctoring of the baseball has only been illegal in Major League Baseball since 1920. The rules went on the books. So why, literally 100 years later, why is this a problem now?
Well, the short answer is because the hitters aren't hitting anymore and they're trying to help them out. You know, so many things have happened in the last few years that have been, you know, more in favor of the pitching, a higher velocity, sometimes a bigger strike zone, and then the foreign substance stuff. You know, it's kind of been a wink, wink, nod thing where, you know, we're not going to complain about your pitchers using sticky stuff if you don't complain about ours. But, you know, that rosin bag's always been on the back of the mound, but then guys started mixing in a little bit with some sunscreen. And now apparently they've gone to things, a product called Spider Tack, which the strong man competition contestants use to lift big stones and things like that, not a little baseball. And so, you know, before we get on to super glue and Gorilla Glue, they're just trying to stop that now. And so, but it's, pun intended, a sticky situation, because the hitters want the pitchers to be able to grip the ball to a certain extent so that they don't, you know, get beamed in the coconut by pitches, although HBPs are kind of high this year as it is. So, you know, they would like some type of middle ground where you can, they can find something that works without giving the pitchers a huge advantage. It's all about spin rate. You know, there's many new analytic ways of gauging how baseball's going now, and spin rate is one of the new vogue things. And the more you spin a ball, the more it's going to move. It actually, on a fastball, can make it look like what they, in the old days, they would call a rise ball, you know, a ball that rises. And a ball that's moving is harder to hit. And I don't mean moving forward. I mean moving right in other directions.
Yeah, you're not a physicist, and neither am I, Tom, but the gist is the gunk on the ball affects that spin rate you were just talking about and makes those pitches break a little peppier. Is that basically what's going on here? That makes it harder for the hitter?
Yeah, break and move and stuff like that. So, you know, when you have velocity in the 90 and above range, and boy, have we gotten into an age where it seems like everybody's throwing at least 95. When you have high velocity, it's hard enough to hit the baseball. But when you also put in crazy movement, even harder. And so they're just trying to level the playing field a little bit. The tough thing about this is they're doing it in season, and that's because they wanted a couple of months to, quote-unquote, gather evidence. And so apparently they gathered enough evidence to make them think it's out of hand. But, it, you know, usually rule changes or rule enforcements take place at the start of a season and give all the players time to figure this stuff out. So let's just see how this goes. Already one pitcher, a really good pitcher, Tyler Glasnow of the Tampa Bay Rays, who's now out with an elbow injury, said he stopped using sticky stuff, and he had to grip the ball harder than ever to get it to go where he wanted, and he thinks he hurt his elbow because of it. So if guys are going to start getting hurt, boy, is that going to be tough to deal with.
Talking to Tom Hodricourt, Brewers beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at new enforcement from Major League Baseball on what they used to call spitballs, but baseballs doctored by pitchers or their accomplices with foreign substances. Tom, you said the E word there a few moments ago, enforcement. How? Yeah. How are they going to enforce this?
Well, you know, according to the memo, the crew chiefs of the umpiring crews will be checking pitchers as they come into games, before games, between innings, you know, supposedly not during play, which would just create delays. You know, games are already long enough. But let's see what happens, you know, how much are they going to undress them? You know, is it going to be just looking under the cap, looking in the glove? You know, where are they going to look for it? And how are they going to look for it? And, you know, supposedly it's if you're caught using a foreign substance, it's going to be automatic ejection and then a 10-game suspension. So that, and you can't replace those players on the roster either if they're suspended for breaking that rule. So this has an effect on teams as well. So it's going to be very interesting just to see what happens. You know, pitchers, they fired this warning shot across the bow a couple of weeks ago. So I think they're hoping they'll stop on their own and that none of these inspections are going to find anything. It's, you know, it's not like they haven't been forewarned.
Have we seen before and after? Is there enough data to say, hey, yeah, we're seeing fewer strikeouts, more hits?
Well, let's find out. You know, the Brewers offense has been struggling. So if pitchers they've been facing lately have stopped using, it hasn't helped them. You know, I was looking today, the average team batting average now, the mean, the one right in the middle of the 30 teams is .238. You know, you used to couldn't play in the big leagues if you only batted .238. And so there's no question we're in a period of diminished offense. You know, remember in the late 90s and early 2000s when the steroids were being used, we had this ridiculous increased offense. And then they, you know, banned those and started suspending players for using. And then it's sort of the pendulum swung back towards the pitchers. And I think, you know, there's nothing wrong with a good pitcher's duel, but the less action you have in baseball, the less fun it is to watch. Don't you agree?
Well, yeah. And I mean, the trend, it seems like over time, even before this latest enforcement, was more strikeouts and more home runs, which for my money have been the two most boring plays in baseball. I want the ball in play. Yeah. I want people running around bases like they need to.
We don't have rallies anymore. We don't have many stolen bases. We don't have hit and runs. We don't, the line doesn't keep moving, you know, and so it gets boring. You know, you had the one swing for a couple of runs, maybe a home run, and then nothing. And strikeouts, you know, it used to be a bad thing to strike out. I was talking to Ted Simmons the other day. You know, he's going to be inducted into the Hall of Fame this year. And he played for the Brewers during their glory years in the early 80s. And he never struck out more than 50 times in a season. And now guys strike out 50 times in a couple of months. You know, and so it's just like part of the game. Now we're in this swing and miss, you know, home run or strikeout or what we call the two true outcomes, either strikeout or home runs. And I don't think that's very entertaining. That's okay in home run derby, but home run derby's the day before the All-Star game, not every single day of the season.
Before we let you go, Tom, let's check in on the Brewers' strong start. A little bit of up and down. Second place now in the division, I think, and not too far behind. Your assessment of where they are now?
Yeah, they've been carried by their pitching. You know, their hitting has been very problematic. They have a four-game losing streak going into their Friday night game here in Denver. And it's almost all related to not scoring. You know, they've only scored they scored four runs in three games, getting swept at home by the Reds. And then Thursday night, they had three runs, all with one swing, a three-run double by Luis Urias. So they got to get going offensively. They've wasted a lot of good pitching, and they certainly wouldn't be a game behind the Cubs without their pitching. And so if the pitching's going to level off now with a sticky gate, you know, as we are calling it, then the offense has to pick up. And so we'll see if they can do it. They've had a lot of injuries too. So we need to put that qualifier in there, a lot of injuries. And that certainly has hampered them. So they're looking to get some guys back. Colton Wong, their second baseman, they're hoping to get back today. You know, Yelich missed a month. Kane's been out. Travis Shaw dislocated his shoulder. He's out for a long time. So injuries have been a factor, but that's part of the season and you got to play through them.
Tom, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tom Hodricourt is the Brewers beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We talked to him today about Major League Baseball's crackdown on pitchers loading up the balls with foreign substances and got a quick update there on the Brewers' season so far. Coming up, we'll take a look at the quest to develop electric flying cars. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, a summer summit, a new federal holiday, and GM pours billions into a new plant to build more batteries. Those are a few of the stories you'll hear on the Friday News Roundup today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now imagine you're in a big bustling city and you got to go from point A across town to point B. You hop in a car, got to stop every couple blocks for red lights. When you're actually moving, it's pretty slow because there's so much traffic. Wouldn't it be great to have a flying car and skip all of that? Well, people have been working on that idea for some years now. There have been some recent developments. For one, plans were announced earlier this year to make Florida home to 10 electric flying taxi hubs. But we might have to wait a long time for this dream to become reality. Cade Metz is a New York Times reporter with the New York Times who covers artificial intelligence, driverless cars, robotics, virtual reality, and other emerging areas. Cade, welcome to Central Time.
Glad to be here.
You looked at some of these prototypes. They're not exactly what I might envision of a flying car. What kind of things are in the works? Can you describe them for us?
You're right. They're not what you envision. I liked how you teased our conversation before the break, where you sort of had a half question mark at the end of flying car. these are called flying cars in Silicon Valley. You know, a part of the country that's very different than the rest of it. They've been under development for about 10 years. And, you know, when they call them that, they, whether they mean to or not, these engineers and entrepreneurs invoke visions of the Jetsons and the like. And that's their ultimate dream, is to put these in the skies above urban areas and kind of take us all, you know, through the air over the traffic below. But as you point out, that dream is very far from reality. What these are at this point are prototypes of electric vehicles that can take off like a helicopter and then transition and fly like an airplane. If you could get regulatory approval for that, if you had the infrastructure that would allow these things to take off and land, they could serve like flying cars. But there are so many hurdles, those and others, to get over before we get there.
Let's take them one at a time. First of all, these prototypes, do they actually fly as intended?
So that was what I set out to do with this story that published in the Times on Sunday, is to find out who had a prototype that actually worked. There are about four of them that fly as I described, taking off vertically and then flying horizontally. The most interesting one, the most fascinating prototype, is called Blackfly, and it's built by this company called Opener, which grew out of kind of a project that was nurtured for about a decade by a guy named Marcus Ling, who's a Canadian inventor who moved to Silicon Valley. It looks like something out of a sci-fi movie. It's half helicopter, half airplane. It's got a wing on its nose and a wing on its tail, and then rotors like you'd see on a helicopter lined up along each wing. And it does take off completely vertically and then in an instant transition to vertical flight. It's a really fascinating thing to watch.
Can you talk about the markets people are thinking of here? Are they going to be priced to where, you know, I mean, a fairly well-off person but not a billionaire could actually buy one of these for themselves personally?
Yeah, that's where things start to get iffy, and then they get more iffy as we go along. So Marcus Ling has built this really fascinating aircraft, but he does not have regulatory approval to fly this over cities. That probably won't happen for years. But what he wants to do is he wants to essentially sell it to rich people. And he's going to start doing that probably this year. He won't say how much this will cost, but the odds are it's going to cost $150,000, maybe more. He's hopeful that he can eventually get this down to the what he calls the cost of an SUV and sell it to a broader range of people. But it would still be limited to rural areas. So basically, if you had a place far from a city where you could fly this thing, you could fly it.
So there's kind of more of a toy. But I imagine if people want to really make money on this, they want it to be in service where lots of humans live, and that means cities, right?
That does. And so there's a different path to that. You've got these other companies. Kitty Hawk is one. Which was also funded by the Google co-founder Larry Page, much like Opener is funded by Larry Page. And their vision is very different. They have a prototype that flies in much the same way, but it's a little more complex, more expensive. It's more suited to flight over a city, but they're going to need regulatory approval to do that. And they hope to get that in the coming years. But the other thing is that the vehicle is so expensive, they know it's not something that the average person can buy. And so what they want to do is turn it into an air taxi. They want to build a service that operates something like Uber does today on the ground, only, you know, with these flying cars, as they call them. So that's the plan. But there's another hurdle to that. There's not enough room for a pilot. At this point, there's only one seat. They want to expand to two, but in order to make this work, they want these things to fly by themselves. And that's going to take some doing to maybe technically, but more importantly, regulatory-wise.
Talking to Cade Metz from the New York Times about what may be the flying vehicles of the future, electric flying taxis coming not soon to a city near you, but maybe somewhere down the road. Oh, no, Cade, okay, hang on. We've got the challenges of making these flying vehicles, getting regulatory approval, but we want them to fly themselves. And we haven't exactly figured out how to have self-driving cars safely and successfully, right? I mean, that's a double challenge.
That's exactly right. Now, there's an argument that says achieving autonomy in the air is easier than on the ground, right? You don't have to deal with all that traffic and a lot of the uncertainty that you do on the ground. And that argument does make sense. But at the same time, we're talking about flying electric vehicles. Those have never been approved for flight. First, we've got to figure out how to just get these things approved with a pilot. Then we can think about the autonomy piece. There's a lot that needs to happen. But, you know, one of the reasons people, you know, are starting to point to this type of thing as viable, one of the reasons you mentioned Florida moving in this direction, is that we now have just tons of money being invested in this. We see these huge deals, we're talking billions of dollars being pumped into these companies. And some of them, you know, with that money in hand, want to deploy these air taxi services with a pilot first. They've got prototypes that can accommodate more seats, including a pilot. So they feel like that's a first step. And that's probably what's going to happen first.
You know, there's a lot of experience flying stuff as airlines. Are they getting into this business at all?
They are. You know, United, its investment arm is investing in one of these companies that seeks to do this. This is probably, first off, a way to make it easier for you to get to and from the airport. You know, we've got, you know, helicopter landing pads and the like. And so that's probably how this is going to happen first. It's going to be more like a shuttle, but it's potentially less expensive than a helicopter, maybe safer, maybe quieter. The dream is to ultimately make this more prevalent and inexpensive than helicopters. We'll see how quickly that can happen.
Now, Cade, one concern that I have is I see how people drive in two dimensions on roads, and that's not always great. I mean, is anybody talking about a future where ordinary consumers are just hopping and they're flying whatever and bopping around town with all the concerns that raises?
Well, some people in Silicon Valley are. Marcus Ling is one, the guy behind that prototype Blackfly. Like, once he gets this into the hands of these wealthy people, he feels like he can turn some heads and eventually get this, you know, into the hands of others. But, you know, that's going to take some doing. And that's in part because of that problem you talk about. You know, we have concerns already with cars and drivers here on the ground that can become, you know, even more dicey in the air. So we'll see how quickly that can happen, if ever.
And briefly, we've talked about rural areas, not a lot of competition in the skies, cities, a lot of regulatory problems. You touch on the suburbs as a possible market. In our last few moments, can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that makes the most sense, you know, essentially providing shuttles from the suburbs to downtown or to airports. That's what a lot of these companies are talking about. And even cities, you know, we've talked to cities in California, for instance. LA is an example. They've built a not-for-profit specifically to look at this idea and build the infrastructure that's needed and think about a lot of these issues to try to alleviate at least some of the traffic on the ground.
Cade, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Cade Metz is a reporter with the New York Times who covers artificial intelligence, driverless cars, robotics, virtual reality, and other emerging technology areas. We talked to them today about the ongoing quest to develop electric flying taxis. Probably not coming to a city near you anytime soon, but concepts gaining traction and a lot of investors are interested. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer-Kent. Monday at 8, get a firsthand look at growing and using medicinal herbs with a Wisconsin organic farmer. That's Monday at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll look at a new report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum about the lack of diversity in the state's teacher workforce. Remember, today on Food Friday, we talked about grilling steaks with Meathead Goldwyn. Still looking for your favorite bit of advice when it comes to grilling. Whatever you grill, share your techniques, advice over on the Ideas Network Facebook page and let us know what you're cooking this weekend and what time I can show up. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.